early next week and continued warm temperatures. WGTD News Time is exactly 10 after 8. The morning show with yours truly is coming up next. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackanddrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. Today's morning show interview is actually out of the archives, an interview recorded back in 2005. I think anybody who loves the game of football, particularly anyone who's played the game and wishes they were still playing the game, is going to really enjoy the book that we're going to talk about over the next few minutes called Dream Season. A professor joins America's oldest semi-pro football team. It is written by Bob Couser Jr., or should I say Professor Bob Couser Jr., who is Associate Professor of English at St. Lawrence University. And in this particular book, Bob Couser tells us about an interesting adventure when he had the opportunity right around the age of 30 to return to one of the great loves of his life, playing football for this semi-pro football team, the Red and Black. And we're going to talk with him about what this experience meant to him and also what it felt like to write about it. And we'll talk even a little bit about the, what might seem to some to be a rather unlikely intersection between love of the English language and literature and love of the bruising life of a football player. Professor Bob Couser, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you.
Tell us, first of all, a little bit about the earliest phase of your love of the game of football, what kind of playing you did, and then what sort of took you away from playing football.
I grew up in a pretty football-crazy part of the state of Tennessee, and probably the whole state of Tennessee is pretty football-crazy. And I remember, as I write in the book, I remember convincing my parents that I needed to stay home from Sunday Mass in order to watch the NFL Game of the Week narrated by Jack Whitaker when I was probably 4 or 5 years old. And I always loved it both as a fan and as a player, and I played in high school. To some, you know, there wasn't any great glory, but, I was a starter all 3 years and really enjoyed myself. And it was the only sport I was ever really any good at because it didn't require any real athletic skill. It really required running into people as hard as you could. After high school, I think I was waiting for the big phone call from Tom Osborne at Nebraska or somebody like that, and it never came. And so, my parents were university professors, and I knew college was going to be important. And I thought, well, I'll just set this football aside and just be a student. And that lasted for about 15 years.
Let me take you back to high school for just a second.
Sure.
So you're a starter on the football team.
Yep.
Now, at that point in time, were you also a good student? I mean, were you writing great papers for English class and so on?
I think that may have been the extent of my great studenthood would have been. I was the prize pupil in my advanced English class, but I really struggled through chemistry and things like that. So mm-hmm. I was up and down, I would say.
But it sounds like you were a serious student. Now, were you growing up in a place where it was okay to be a starter on the football team and a devoted student, or was this a side of you that you had to, in some ways, keep hidden?
Definitely. Well, I'll put it to you this way. My football coach made fun of me in front of the whole team because I was the only member of the football team in the Honor Society. So that tells you about, it was difficult to move between those two worlds back there, I guess.
Wow.
Yeah.
And took a little bit of guts on your part to plant one foot in each world.
Well, my parents, I don't think, would have had it any other way. They would have ended the football career if I weren't able to keep up in school. So I knew that. And I did have a sense, that even at an early age, that I wanted to be, I think when I walked onto a college campus the first time, I realized, wow, this is, I want to do this forever. And I knew the way to do that would be become one of them and become a professor. So I was lucky that my parents always, always reminded me football would end at some point, or at least they thought it would, mm-hmm. and I would need to go on and get a real job.
You got your PhD in creative writing from the University of Nebraska. Can we assume that you were drawn to the University of Nebraska for the splendor of its creative writing program and that it had nothing to do with their football?
I can't honestly tell you that it had nothing to do with football. I was a huge Nebraska fan as a little kid. It's strange growing up in Tennessee where they have their own very serious college football program, but they weren't very good, frankly, in the 70s and 80s. And partly, I think it was, I just didn't want to like the same team everybody in school liked. So I can't tell you what it was about Nebraska, but I liked the way they chewed up the yardage on the ground, and I liked all their Heisman-winning running backs. And so when I came to apply for graduate programs, and I applied for 10, and actually I was living in Milwaukee at the time. I was finishing a master's at Marquette, and it certainly had something to do with it. And then when I was there, they won 3 national titles in my 4 years at Nebraska.
Wow. What years were you there?
94 through 98. Hmm. So they lost 2 games during that stretch, and I went to almost every home game and lots of road games, and that's when I think the football fever sort of came back.
I got a master's degree in music from Nebraska in 1984.
Oh, wow.
And that was just as football had taken off in a very dramatic way, and my second year at Nebraska was the year they nearly won the Orange Bowl, lost by 2 points. And I remember that was on New Year's Day. I'm pretty sure I remember us being out for supper, but arranging for the radio in the restaurant to be turned to the coverage of that and listening breathlessly to the closing minutes of that big game.
Yeah. Well, in Lincoln, that wouldn't have been any surprise for somebody to have the radio playing the Husker game. I mean, it's such a unique community in that way, I always thought.
Now, back in your high school days, how big a guy were you? Because one of the things you talk about in the book is that while we would look at you and immediately maybe guess that you're a football player, in fact, you're not particularly tall, not particularly big. Yeah. As a high school player, were you decent size for your age?
I don't know. Not really. I was about 5'9" and about 175 in my first season, and then up to maybe 190 by the time that I graduated. But certainly not big enough to play the positions that I was playing. But that's the way high school is a lot of times, I was smallish, I would say.
One of the things that I think is quite intriguing in your book is that you explore a little bit of the psychology that was probably going on inside of you and inside of the minds and hearts of some of your teammates in this semi-pro team which you eventually joined. When you say that giving up tackle football is maybe one of the hardest things to do, because maybe unlike other sports where you can give it up on a very competitive level but still engage in it in some kind of way, there isn't a whole lot out there for ex-football players.
Right. Yeah, and it's very true. It's a cold turkey kind of thing when you give up football. And I think also it's different maybe I don't remember, there's not a homecoming game for the baseball team. There was just so much pageantry, at least where I grew up, surrounding football. And then it was gone, it was over, and nothing else in my life ever seemed to have that same kind of thing. And as I said, I don't have great hand-eye coordination. I don't play golf, or I don't bowl, I don't play pool. And so that competitive, the competitive drive was not gone. And it was hard to sort of give up the game, like I say, cold turkey. And as I write about in the book, I tried several times to play touch football and flag football and things like that, and they're just not the same game at all. And I actually was thrown out of a flag football league for tackling, and I just couldn't stop myself. A guy would cross my face with the ball, and I would tackle him, and it seemed like the most natural thing in the world.
Hmm. I'm struck by a quote you make of New York Times columnist Robert Lipsty saying, "By puberty, most American males have already become failed athletes. We are left to watch and cheer those who made the cut that we didn't make. So I imagine for you, you tasted at least a little bit of that.
Of having been a failed athlete?
Well, I mean, in the sense that at some point in time, it wasn't possible for you to play football anymore. I mean, when you get to, for instance, or did you play in college?
I didn't. In fact, I went to a school purposely that didn't have college football because I knew that if I went there, I would end up hanging around the football team either as a player or as a manager or something because it just the pull of the game was so strong for me. Yeah, I definitely felt that. And I noticed other men feeling it too. And, you know, one of the things I wanted to do with the book was sort of stare down the real reasons why my football career ended. You know, I mean, you know, it's very common for somebody to blame their high school coach and, oh, if he'd played me more, played me at the right position, or if he'd contacted colleges about me. You know, I wanted to look it in the face and say, what was it really? And it came down to the fact that I was short and slow and not necessarily the most courageous guy at all times. You know, they talk about players who have big hearts and, you know, they never quit. And, you know, I'm much too analytical and thoughtful and, you know, to really play that way. And so, and that's a lot of what this book is about, is going back as a grown-up who can hopefully look at himself seriously and critically and figure out, you know, what were the limits of my game. And
come to terms with it.
Come to terms with it, which I feel like I have. I mean, you know, I had one skill, which was that I could hit hard. But I'm not one of those guys, and I played with them, you know, at every level, who just don't quit, who just have that ability, that belief in themselves and that tremendous ability to give, you know, to give effort all game long, no matter how the game is going. I tend to, you know, to think way too much. And, you know, there's a quote in the book from Hemingway that imagination is great for the writer, but death for the soldier. Mm. And I kind of feel that way as a writer, that if I didn't overthink everything, I wouldn't be a writer or a writing teacher. But sometimes it was crippling for me as a football player. I would size up every situation, and I would lose heart when it seemed like we weren't going to win this game or I wasn't going to beat this opponent across the line of scrimmage from me. That doesn't help you as a player, really.
Hmm. One thing that you say towards the beginning of the book is that professors and football players are natural enemies. That's a rather provocative thing to say, especially for a professor who also is a football player.
Right.
But tell us, first of all, what you meant by that.
Well, a couple of things. I mean, you know, and we actually literally, you know, the first football game was, you know, the first college game. After the first college game, professors at universities like Princeton and Columbia fielded some of the first teams, lobbied for, you know, to abolish football because this is what they called the red meat era. And, you know, in 1905, I believe 71 men were killed playing football because, you know, they didn't have good equipment. You weren't really down until you stopped moving so that you could get knocked to the ground but get back up and keep running. And so tackling was really vicious. And so university faculty looked at this and thought, this is not good. And really were actually opponents of it, so that they were very literally enemies of the game. And more recently, there's a guy at Rutgers who I write about who started a movement at Rutgers University to abolish football because he thinks that their prolonged ineptitude as a football team makes, you know, damages the self-esteem of the entire university. That's his argument, and that it's just a waste of money and they need to get rid of it. But I think, you know, also just, you know, my colleagues, for example, at St. Lawrence, who are my friends and are nice people and are writers and readers, have told me, oh, you know, I read your book, I skipped the football parts. I mean, they just, you know, they want to be nice, they want to support me, but they just don't care. And I think maybe they sense what I sense about it, that the thoughtfulness that we prize in ourselves as writers and teachers is, you know, is not useful to them on the football field, and what they perceive to be the violence of the game, which they don't understand, seems brutish to them. And so, you know, in some ways I wanted the book to be kind of an apology for football in the classic sense of, you know, trying to make a case for it to an audience that otherwise would be kind of, averse to the game.
Right. I don't remember, does St. Lawrence have football?
They do. We don't happen to be very good, but they're improving since I've been here. The head coach is a guy about my age, and I like him a lot, and I think he's slowly turning the team around. It's like the Rutgers situation. I mean, they've been down a long time. They don't have scholarships. It's hard to convince good players that they want to play here, and they're also competing against a really powerful hockey team that's a Division I hockey team. So it's hard to field, I think, two really strong sport teams in two, you know, two sports like that.
Right. Over the years, as you've taught there, have you had very many football player / English majors or otherwise football player students in your courses? I mean, are there many young men that cross the divide as you have?
You know, not really. Most of the football players I've had, and I've had several really good ones, I had in first year program courses that we had, not really in the upper division writing courses, but I had one several years ago who was actually quite good. This was difficult for me because I didn't want to get sort of labeled as the sports writing teacher because I thought that would really box me in a little bit. And so I actually had some misgivings about writing the book altogether because I had tried so hard all those years to separate myself from my football days and be a serious academic. And that's starting to happen a little bit now. And what I do is I say to the guys, look, or the women who come in to do it, I say, look, you know, one sports essay per class, per semester. And everything else will have to be about something else. Because, I tire of it a little bit myself. And I think sports writing is difficult because it's plagued by such cliche. I mean, Sports Center is nothing but the same phrases over and over and over again. And I'm trying to get them to do something different. But to answer your actual question, I mean, you know, a handful of football player writers. But we're a small liberal arts school, so we have, you know, pretty interesting, well-rounded kids here.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Bob Couser, Jr., who's the author of Dream Season, A Professor Joins America's Oldest Semi-Pro Football Team. I think we've nicely set the stage for what becomes this seminal moment when you decide that you want to return to the football field one way or another. Did anything in particular inspire that?
Man, you know, like I say, I mean, years of just every game I ever went to, my stepson played junior high and junior varsity football when he lived with us. And even standing on the sidelines of his games, I was restless. And it wasn't a restlessness to coach. I sensed that. It was, that would not have done it. I wanted to play. And he teased me one day and he said, you know, we were arguing about teams that were playing on television and about styles of play. And he said, you know, the difference between you and me is that you watch football, but I actually play. And I think more, my wife thinks, at least more than anything, it was that remark that pushed me over the edge into insanity and made me actually go out and play again.
You talk at one point about how football, for many of these years, had to remain a guilty secret pleasure. And so at long last, you were able to sort of lift the veil of secrecy away from it.
Right.
And pursue it a bit more openly. I think one of the most interesting things you do in the book is you help us understand this this world that many of us don't really directly encounter of semi-pro football. And one of the things you say is that the teams that remain in some of these relatively small cities and communities are very, very important for the sense of identity that those communities have.
Yeah, you know, for example, this Watertown team, there's actually a Watertown Red and Black, that's the team I play for, a Watertown Red and Black uniform on display in the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio. So that it's a real anchor to civic identity for this community, and they receive all kinds of media attention that seemed at the time that I moved here kind of undue in a way for a team that was, you know, an unpaid, you know, I assumed it was something more like arena football when I first started playing. But I realized that, you know, having talked, to newspaper writers and to television reporters, that it's the summertime sports story in this area, and that even if they aren't big-time football, they are 108 years old. And there's a team in Glens Falls, New York, that's 75 years old. I mean, and they're institutions. And they're an important way for Watertown to hold on to some identity and to distinguish itself from bigger cities like Syracuse.
Mm-hmm. What actually earns it the distinction of semi-pro? I mean, are we talking about a particular financial threshold? And in what way is this related to, for instance, the minor leagues of professional baseball, for instance?
Well, it's funny. We shared a locker room with a single-A baseball team, the Watertown Wizards. And they were none of those players were paid either. It's a college summer league. And, I think that summer league is like the football league in the sense that it's not actually officially attached to a major league baseball organization. The best players in our league, for example, end up getting tryouts with Arena League football teams. So that gives you some sense of the level of play. But semi-pro, I think, is really it's really better described as adult amateur football. The semi-pro is a holdover from the early days when guys took a percentage of the till at the end of the game. But you know, when Watertown first started playing, and you couldn't watch games, any game you wanted on TV on Sunday. The only football game you could watch in Watertown was the Red and Black, and they drew 5,000 and 6,000 people per game. That was in the 20s and 30s. And of course, you know, that's over now, and as I say, you can watch any game you'd like on satellite. But at the time that the team started, but according to legend anyway, Curly Lambeau actually contacted the owner of the Watertown team to see if he was interested in becoming part of this fledgling thing called the NFL. And, you know, the funny thing is that Green Bay is you know, not all that much bigger than Watertown. And Green Bay has managed, you know, to hang on to this team. And Watertown, it's one of their claims to fame. I was never able to dig up whether or not there was any truth to that at all, but they certainly believe that's true around here.
Intriguing. You mentioned, by the way, in passing, in talking about the Red and Black, that they are one of more than 500 semi-pro football franchises currently playing across the country. I was astonished to hear that. I would not have guessed that semi-pro football was quite that prevalent.
No, you know, the first that I ever heard of semi-pro football was the Racine Raiders when I lived in Milwaukee.
Yes.
It was the first team I ever knew about. But, yeah, I mean, there are 50 teams simply in the state of New York. There are 50 teams. It's a little subculture that, and I'm like you, and I'm a big football fan, but I didn't know anything about it. And when I discovered that, that's when I thought, this is a book that I have to write, because, you know, this is something that, you know, most of America doesn't even know goes on. And these are serious, you know, as you know, football is a serious collision, you know, violent sport, and that guys would go out and do this for absolutely no recognition and no money was just kind of amazing to me.
You described the incredible array of players that were a part of this team as you became part of it. And very intriguing to read about the range of talent, the range of experience, and just the variety of human beings that that populated this team.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the great pleasures for me, was getting to know these guys. And you know, I have to be honest, I probably would have remained cloistered in my, you know, ivory tower as an academic and not met prison guards and grocers and, you know, but I did and, you know, came to find out, of course, that we had a lot more in common than either of us would have been willing to admit in the beginning. They called me professor from the very first day, and at first, as I write in the book, at first it was an epithet.
And they called you profess for short, right?
Yeah, profess for short, right. But, you know, by the end of it, and I don't think any of them, most of them had ever met a college professor. I think I had 3 advanced degrees at that point, and I think that tied the total of everybody else on the team combined.
Wow.
And by the end of it, though, Professor was, you know, and when I play against them now, and I play for another team that I helped to start up here closer to where I live, and when we play, they call me Professor, and it sounds like a term of endearment. So that, to me, was the biggest success of the whole project, was that we got to, you know, I made friends that I would have otherwise never made.
We learn a lot about sort of the dynamics of how this team operated and some of the really tough characters who were some of the coaches. I thought what was especially interesting was when you talked about the importance of equipment.
Yeah.
And who got the right equipment and what that sort of meant in terms of your status on the team. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about.
Well, I mean, I don't know that any other sport for me anyway, I mean, I think one of the great appeals of the game, even from the time that I was 5 years old watching the NFL, was how great guys looked in their pads. And then once I first got them on for the first time, you know, I would have been happy to stand on the sidelines all season just so I could wear a football helmet again. But when we started to, at the beginning of the year, when we started to have contact practices, of course, the team started to distribute the equipment. And I write about the day that some of us rookie players were being given equipment in advance of some of the veteran players, and they were very upset. And the reason was because, you know, it was a status symbol. The guys with the best-looking face masks, for example, it indicated a pecking order on the team. And one of the things I loved about playing second time around was, unlike in high school when I didn't have any money, I mean, I could buy myself, and I did, you know, the top of the line, every single bit of equipment. And I spent, I won't tell you how much money on, you know, extra cool stuff that was really just for looks. And my wife knew that. And as I write in the book, I mean, she was trying to get my credit card away from me as the boxes from across the country came by UPS. But, you know, and that was a lot. I think that probably is appeal, a lot of the appeal for all the guys. Everybody trying to top everybody else with, you know, the name brand sweatbands and football gloves and titanium face masks. And
well, and you know, and even aside from that, I love how you say at one point, I had been excited. I had been as excited about wearing pads again as about anything else. I mean, I appreciate your honesty there in saying that just having football pads on again,
yeah,
meant almost as much to you, maybe as much as actually getting out on the field and playing again.
Oh yeah, definitely. And yeah, I watched development in football equipment in my 15 years away, and my brother and I used to sit around and draw face masks as a pastime and say, oh, this is my favorite one. It's the one that Walter Payton has or whatever. So it was great to have picked a favorite one over the years and then had the opportunity. You know, not just for sport, to actually go out and buy it and wear it was just great. And I know that, you know, may be hard for the average listener to relate to, but, you know, I think a lot of it for me, the appeal was always how cool they looked.
One of the things you talk about as you first began contact practices with the red and black, you rewind for a moment and kind of tell us about how you developed your love for the hit. And you explain how, as a really young football player, that was actually not easy for you at all. You said, as the ball carrier approached, I think you were playing linebacker back then, I'd stand straight up and shift around like a basketball defender as the tailback ran past me into the open field. Afraid of the unknown, the contact, I could not force the moment to its crisis. And you ended up being pulled by your coach because you just didn't have that sense of contact. You talk, though, about how you quickly developed, or maybe not so quickly, but at some point developed what you call a craving for contact, and became someone who really loved that part of the game and embraced it wholeheartedly. And I suppose you had to get back to that sense as you returned to football over a decade later.
Yeah, that's what I really wondered about almost as much as anything else, was could I get that back? Was it going to be like riding a bicycle? I heard ex-Denver coach Dan Reeves say in an interview one time that, you know, hitting is like, it was like a puppy. If he didn't bark when he was a puppy, he wasn't going to bark when he was a dog. You couldn't really teach somebody to love, to be a hitter, to love contact. I mean, I think what I realized was, I was actually playing defensive back there in seventh grade, and so there was always a receiver, and I would just sort of chicken fight with him while the guy ran past me. And that meant losing my spot on the starting defense, and then I didn't play my freshman year, and I stood on the sidelines at every game and watched. And I think it dawned on me that if I was going to be a part of that, it meant I was going to have to embrace that and throw my body in the mix and just take whatever, you know, came my way. Once I started to do that, you know, I found out that actually, you know, I was well-suited to it. But by nature, I think I'm kind of a timid, you know, non-confrontational, risk-averse person, and it was hard for me to do.
You talk about one drill, I think, in practices that you likened to a medieval joust, in which I think you had to line up 10 yards apart and then just kind of run at another player and give them a hit while they were hitting you.
Yeah, I mean, you'd lie on your back. It's called Nutcracker. and they blow the whistle, and you pop up and turn over and face the other guy and run as hard as you can at him. And that was before I knew what a concussion was, and I now realize I probably had several. But I got really good at that drill, and because it didn't kill me the first time, I thought, well, here we go. And the weird thing was, that kind of aggression I had to sort of factor out of my life after football. And, because that, though it works well on the football field, it's not good in the rest of your life. And I thought the scariest parts of going back to football again was to actually try to be that way again on the field and then turn it off when I was off the field, when it was unacceptable. And I think we see a lot of football players struggling with that.
Right.
It's not an easy, on off switch in some ways. But as I found out, it was actually, I could get it back. And now that I weighed, 50 pounds more than I did in high school, it was actually, I was actually even better at it than I had remembered.
You shift to offensive linemen, and you talk a lot about sort of the mindset of offensive linemen being a really kind of unique creature in the world of football, and it's very, very hard work. And it takes a certain kind of person to be able to really do it and even enjoy it.
Yeah, I've noticed on both of the semi-pro teams that I've played on, the offensive linemen are the tightest-knit group because, as they'll tell you, the NFL players always say this, there's no statistics for an offensive lineman, and there's no very, very rarely recognition unless they screw up and jump off sides or something like that. And so, their pleasure comes from the esprit de corps they have with each other. And, I wasn't well-suited to that as a 16-year-old kid getting no recognition. But I found that I actually like it now that I'm, in my 30s and understand, long-sustained effort paying off and things like that. But it's a hard sell to a young kid.
Right.
And in high school, a lot of times, it's just the big guys, the big fat kids who play it. And at the semi-pro level, these guys were serious athletes. They were fast. They were physical. You have to be one of the, other than the quarterback, you have to be among the more intellectual guys on the field or analytical minds on the field because you're, at this level anyway, guys are shifting around right up to the snap of the ball. And you can't count on the person you're supposed to block being where you think he's going to be. And I found that difficult for me, very difficult to try to make the right block and things like that.
I think you're talking about the offensive lineman specifically at one point in the book when you said, I learned quickly that neither friendships nor playing time came easily among this group. Offensive linemen cultivate something of a collective identity, and they don't take to newcomers. Did that come as a surprise to you, and was that difficult for you?
I can't say that I was surprised, but it was difficult. I put my best foot forward. I tried to be my witty, clever self, and I tried to, be open to these guys and make friends. And they had all been friends. A lot of them, three of the five, had gone to high school together. So they weren't really, I was kind of like this gnat that was buzzing around their face masks. And on top of that, at the beginning, my nerves, I jumped offside several times. It took me a while to learn the offense. And as I said, even if you know what your responsibility is when you break the huddle, when you get to the line of scrimmage and you see an alignment you don't recognize, I would ask guys on left or my right for help about what my responsibility was going to be. And they would just roll their eyes at me. Sometimes they told me, sometimes they didn't. Sometimes they wanted to watch me fall on my face. So, I wasn't surprised, but it was difficult. I'm a sensitive guy. It hurt my feelings a bit that they weren't more open.
You played hard. You did not play as much as you probably wanted to play. And one of the things that's really interesting, I think, especially is, for the good moments you had on the field, you're also very honest and frank about talking about the moments when things did not go so well for you on the field as you would have wanted. And I think maybe better than any book I've ever read, I have a better sense of how painful that has to be a player out on the field making mistakes that everybody sees.
Well, that's a high compliment. I appreciate it. I wanted to do that. I mean, as I say, I am a great consumer of sports literature and sports media, And I don't think, I mean, I think players are taught and model for younger players that you always defend yourself, that you always, you don't see NFL players, NBA players scrutinizing bad performances very carefully. But I do that, as a writer, and, I try to do that in everything that I write about. I wouldn't see the point in shining on about everything having been hunky-dory all the time. So I really wanted to do that, to write about what failure feels like, and sort of to give a sort of balanced, honest account of, I tend to be pretty self-deprecating by nature, and so I just tried to do that with the book. And I thought, otherwise it would be, sort of a cheesy Disney story about the guy who made good, and I didn't necessarily do very well, and I just wanted to be honest about it.
Right. Well, and I guess it was a good reminder. I mean, it's something that, all of us that watch football know that when an offensive lineman jumps offside, he is hurting his team in a sense, which makes that kind of offense all the worse. And yet we just don't really stop to think about what must be going through the mind of number 60
right.
when he's called offsides and everybody in the stadium knows it.
Right.
That just can't be an easy thing, at least for certain people who don't like to disappoint others.
Right. No. And I certainly don't like to disappoint others. And I think that's exactly the kind of moment I wanted to write about. As I say at one point in the book, I didn't want to make any excuses, because that's a mental lapse, because I wasn't focused on what was going on, or because I was too nervous about performing well, and I left it at that, and I didn't want to try to make some kind of excuse for poor performance.
As you look back, especially in kind of the opening passage of this experience for you, what would you have changed about the way this team functioned, and particularly the way in which it was coached?
Well, I think coached is an exaggeration in some respects. I mean, I on the one hand, I feel for a guy who tries to coach a team like this. He didn't have scholarships or paychecks to withhold for players who didn't show up, and that happened a lot. All these guys had other jobs, other responsibilities, and as the season started to turn a bit sour here and there, it just didn't seem to behoove them to come to practice. And so I felt for our coach, George Ashcraft, who tried to my analogy is that he's like general manager for the Yankees, Brian Cashman, without a checkbook. And so how do you make people do what you want? And so he did it with smoke and mirrors and lies and manipulations and everything else. And I think people knew that about him. He said to me at one point, and I write about this in the book, these guys love me, but they don't respect me. And I knew that was true, and I knew he had earned that by lying to people and making backroom deals with one player against another player and that kind of thing. And we lost three games to the same team, a team from Syracuse called the Vipers, who were physically very talented and had a lot of Division I college football players and guys who got NFL tryouts at the end of the season and things like that, but who were not very organized and could have been beaten. But I felt like a couple of things, one, we never looked at a game tape ever to look at what they had done to beat us. And that frustrated me, because even in high school, my teams had done that. And then another thing was that I felt like if our team had taken on the role of underdog and done the kinds of things that underdog teams do to beat more gifted teams, onside kicks, varying snap counts, pooch punts, whatever it meant. But this team was so proud of being the oldest team and of having been in the championship game year after year that they couldn't take on any other identity except as the favorite. And we lost worse every time we played that team. And I think that a lot of that was because we were mentally beaten as the season wore on.
We get the sense that in some respects, assumptions were made about how much experience you had, and that level of experience was maybe overestimated, when in fact there were some guys on this team who appeared to you to have relatively little in the way of actual football playing experience, and yet for that group of guys, very little time was spent at all in terms of building technique or fine tuning the techniques for things like blocking and so on. Is that a fair assessment?
That's absolutely true. I think that the players with no football experience might be more the guys on the team that I started here in St. Lawrence County after my season with Watertown. But there were a lot of guys like me who had only high school experience. And, that's very rudimentary. Your technique is very rudimentary in high school, and you don't understand, as I was saying earlier, shifting defenses and different blocking techniques other than simply firing off the ball and trying to beat the guy one-on-one. The starting players on this team, and because of the Army base that was nearby, I mean, these guys were came from all over the country. They had some pretty sophisticated technique and had a lot of experience together, and so that it was difficult for me to find a way to, contribute, because when I got in there, I didn't, a lot of times didn't know what was going on. And as you say, I mean, there was no coaching time given to acclimating new players to a system. You know, you were just thrown in the mix, and if you didn't perform, were pretty quickly dragged out. So that was a bit frustrating too.
Right, and sometimes very rough treatment from the coaches, in a way that to some extent seems a little hard to explain. Where do you think some of that came from?
Hard treatment from the coaches. Well, to be honest with you, I think the players policed it more than the coaches did. I don't know. I mean, in terms of they had a very, very proud team, and they didn't want guys standing on the sidelines that made them look less serious than they thought they were.
Mm.
And I think they just wanted to humiliate the riffraff like me. some of them were insulted at the idea that I would, come out here and frolic on the field with them. And, when I had my white-collar job to go back to, and they sort of felt like I was an intruder. And, I think I managed to prove to most of them that I actually was a football player also.
And you were there to play.
And then I was there to play.
And not play in the sense of
right,
playing around.
Yeah.
I want you to tell us, because I think this is one of the best stories in the book, comes in the chapter called Dream Season, where it is the end of the year banquet for the red and black. And just in terms of what you chose to show up in, tells us a whole lot about this team and how different you ultimately really were from so many of your teammates.
Yeah, well, it's funny because, you'd think after a full season of playing with them that I might have known better. But, I wore the only suit that I owned to the banquet, and I ended up being the only guy not only in a suit but the only guy in a tie. And most of them had on blue jeans and maybe a sweater. They were certainly more dressed up than I'd ever seen them, but it just seemed to mark off once again the differences between me and them. But it was also the moment when I felt closest to those guys. I actually could enjoy a lot of their company, and for many of them, it's the last time that I saw them, because a lot of the guys were soldiers who ended up in Afghanistan or Texas or Louisiana the next month or so, because this was winter of 2001. I certainly once again, indicated pretty clearly, how the different worlds that we inhabited.
And in the meantime, your story goes in another direction with the creation of a new semi-pro team, which you have been a part of, the St. Lawrence Valley Semi-Pro Football Club. Tell us briefly about that.
Well, we just finished. I just went to the banquet for that team, actually, a couple of nights ago, and I announced my retirement at our last game, and they gave me a clock for my retirement just the other night. We started a team. One of the coaches, the Watertown, one of the narrative drives of the book is the feud that goes on between the head Watertown coach, George Ashcraft, and the offensive coordinator, a guy named Mike Britton. And Mike, had been, there were so, he been frustrated for several years at his treatment down there. He was a Hall of Fame Watertown player and actually a semi-pro Hall of Famer and the all-time leading rusher on the team, but he didn't get the respect that he deserved. And so he approached me about maybe starting a team. We both commuted 60 miles each practice, each way to go to practice and to go to the games, and he thought maybe we could start a team, revive a franchise that had been in this area in the 1970s. And we did, due in no small part to my wife's business's contribution to buying the franchise from the league. and we've played four seasons now. We started out, we gave up the seventh most points in the history of minor league football.
Yeah, you were outscored 499-19.
Yes, yes. For those of you playing at home, that means we lost every game by an average of 49-2. We were pretty terrible. But, you know, we went from the oldest team in the country to the youngest team in the country. That was the metaphor we kept saying. And, you know, this year we won three games. We won two our second year. And so, you know, I think we've made strides. And this team, you know, for Mike and I, was not about necessarily winning national tournaments, but about giving the men up here the opportunity that we'd had to play football again. And so many of them were just so happy to, again, have the helmet on and be out on the field. That we consider the whole thing a success.
The book, again, is Dream Season, A Professor Joins America's Oldest Semi-Pro Football Team, published by Atlantic Monthly Press, and the author, Bob Couser, Jr. Bob Couser, Jr., I loved this book, and enjoyed the opportunity to speak with you about it today on The Morning Show.
Listen, I appreciate your attention to it. I really do, and your compliments also.
All right. Monday on The Morning Show, my guest is going to be clinical psychologist Lori Helgo. Dr. Helgo's new book is called Fragile Bully. It is a fascinating examination of narcissism and how narcissism can play out in a lot of different ways, and how there can even be something called collective narcissism, which can help explain the sharp divisiveness in American civic life and political life right now. A very, very interesting book, and I hope that you will make a special point of listening to Monday's morning show. On Tuesday's morning show, I'm very excited to welcome onto the program for the very first time a faculty colleague of mine from the music department at Carthage, Dr. Mark Petering, who, in addition to being an educator at Carthage, is also a very busy and successful composer. And as a matter of fact, a composition of his is going to be featured on next weekend's concert by the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra, a piece called Cityscape. So we will have Professor Petering on Tuesday's morning show talking about his career as a composer and specifically about the work Cityscape that will be played by the Kenosha Symphony. On Wednesday, we're going to be celebrating the 150th anniversary of a women's organization called PEO, the Philanthropic Educational Organization. This group was begun 150 years ago by six women in Mount Pleasant, Iowa, determined to do whatever they could to further the efforts of other women who wanted to earn an education and better their lives. And PEO has been working very hard on that laudable goal ever since, with chapters across the country. And we'll have several representatives of one of the local chapters of PEO joining us on Thursday's program. On Wednesday's program. On Thursday's program, we will be looking forward to the monthly visit of Nan Calvert. And on Friday's morning show, we'll be joined by Dr. Art Sear, who is Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage, director of the Clausen Center, and he will be offering his analysis of current events. Actually, I think I kind of shuffled the order there. I believe Professor Sear will be joining us on Wednesday, and the aforementioned conversation about the 150th anniversary of PEO will be on Friday to finish out the week. So, a look at narcissism, composer Mark Petering, Professor Art Sear, Nan Calvert, and then the anniversary of PEO. That is the outline for some memorable morning shows next week here on WGTD.